I would now like to turn the floor over to the Center for Law and Social Policy.
Thank you, and welcome, everybody. This is Jody Levin, FCNIT class. Our audio conference today is Scheduling Hourly Workers in a Just-in-Time World. Can employees and employers sync the clock? Employers like the idea of having employees at work when they most need them. And new scheduling software helps employers know more and more about when there is demand for workers. But for employees, if that scheduling capacity translates into unpredictable or unstable hours, it can have huge implications, not only for home life, but for access to benefits, too. Today, we'll explore how extensive these issues are for the workforce, their implications, and how one employer views the trade-offs. My guests today are Susan Lambert, Associate Professor at the University of Chicago. Hi, Susan.
Hello.
And Mike Brosius, an Assistant Vice President of Human Resources at Costco. Hey, Mike, how are you doing?
I'm great, thanks, Susan.
Great. The format today is that I will interview both of our guests, and then at the end of this audio conference call, I'll take a live question or two, and as well, I encourage you to email me during this audio conference at Jody, J-O-D-I-E, at class, C-L-A-S-T, .org, if a question comes to your mind for any of our guests. It would help me if your subject line captured the topic that you want to ask a question about and tells me who it is you'd like to ask the question of. Let's start at the top. Susan, tell the audience with a good tagline about you and the kind of research you do.
Well, I study the changing nature of work and especially what we would call lower-level hourly jobs. And specifically, I look at the everyday practices that employers use to balance the needs of business with those of employees. And currently, my research is focused on scheduling practices and hourly jobs.
Well, then I'm glad we really got you on the line here. And Mike, what's the mission for HR at Costco?
Well, we're basically a support group for our warehouses, and we're just an integral part of our open door policy that we've got with our company.
What do you mean open door policy?
Well, you know, we've got a policy with the company as far as, you know, any employee should be able to go to anybody that they want if there's a question or concern that they have, and we're obviously an integral part of that whole conversation between the employees and management and the executives with our company.
Oh, okay. So let's set the stage with some background metrics about workers. First, for Costco, Mike, what are the numbers on your employees? Like how many overall, roughly what percent are hourly, what percent are lower wage, and how do you define that term? Just a little bit of a snapshot.
Okay. Well, we've got about 113,000 employees across the U.S., and with about 90% of those employees being hourly, and obviously the other 10% is our salaried employees. We really don't define any of our employees as lower level. Our starting wages at Costco are $11 or $11.50, depending on the job that they're starting with. And then they move up the pay scale up to $20, conceivably. So I'm not sure any of those would be considered lower level.
And just a quick take, I mean, that's a huge decision in and of itself to be a paying above minimum wage. As a corporate policy, why did you go that direction?
Well, we believe that we're going to get a lot better quality employee the more we pay. They're going to stay with us. They're going to be happier. Our turnover is going to be greatly reduced, which increases our productivity. And we just think we get the best people that way.
Okay. And Susan, for the U.S. as a whole, what's the percent of all workers who are hourly workers?
58% of all wage and salaried workers are paid by the hour. That's 75.3 million Americans. 56% of men hold hourly jobs, and 61% of women are paid by the hour.
And in low-paid jobs, what's the proportion who are hourly?
Well, that's not an easy kind of question to answer.
It's an easy question to ask, though.
Yeah. What we do know is that hourly jobs are concentrated in industries with the highest proportion of low-income workers, so in retail and hospitality and restaurants, and so those workers are at greatest risk of low earnings. And certainly, of course, all minimum wage workers, you know, earn by the hour by definition, and that's 2.2 million workers. But it is important, I think, to realize that not all workers with low earnings are paid by the hour. You know, some people are paid by a piece rate or in agriculture. They might be paid by the day. And some salaries are not enough to provide an adequate income as well.
You know, I think a lot of folks out there in the world, not particularly those on this call, may make an equation between hourly work as the domain of part-time workers. Could you fill us in on that?
Yeah, certainly a greater proportion of workers who hold part-time jobs are paid by the hour than those who hold full-time jobs. But a good share of workers who work full-time are also paid by the hour. So 72% of part-time workers are paid by the hour, but fully 47% of full-time workers are paid by the hour.
47%?
47%. There are, and because there's more full-time workers than hour, you know, than part-time workers, there's more full-time hourly workers than part-time hourly workers. So, for example, 56 million, in 2008, there were 56 million full-time hourly workers, which is 41% of the total workforce.
Hmm. So a key issue about hourly work is that employers can readily change the amount and or the timing of those hours to best match demand, and that helps contain costs. Yet if the amount of hours are changed, that means the worker's income fluctuates. That means income is unstable. If the timing, the schedule, is changed, that means the pay can become unstable unless a worker can make adjustments for things like transportation or childcare or school. Susan, how extensive is the practice of changing the amount of hours given to a worker?
Well, it's hard to get the data on this from the national data sources because what people are asked are questions like, what are the typical number of hours that you work? And so it's very hard to get a good sense of how widespread our fluctuations are. But what we see overall is that there's what is being called a growing precariousness in employment, which includes increasing fluctuations in earnings and hours. So from between the 1970s and now, what we see is about a 23% increase in fluctuations in work hours among workers, suggesting that their hours are being changed. In terms of my research, in which I go into firms and I look at actually what happens, things like posting schedules with a limited advance notice, scheduling workers for different days and different shifts week to week, and last-minute changes to posted schedules are absolutely commonplace, especially in a non-production industry where goods can't be inventory and there's much more of a just-in-time use of labor.
Susan, I'm actually a little bit worried about asking you another national statistic question because it seems to be that the answer is it's really not easy to get a handle. But do you have any data on how extensive the practice is with regard to changing the timing of hours?
We do not. There are not national data sets that, you know, do not, you know, provide that kind of information. But there are questions that ask workers if they can change their start and end times. But there aren't questions that ask how often your schedule is changed by your employer.
And does your research say something to you about this?
Well, yes. I've studied jobs in retail, in hospitality, in transportation, and in financial services. And in some jobs, there is highly concentrated, you know, kind of practices in which people are regularly sent home. Some workers are kept on call to wait by the phone to see if there's enough work for the day. And so these, you know, posting schedules at the last time, making changes after they're posted, sending workers home during the day, calling workers in are common practice in a lot of industries today, especially in these, you know, kind of what we would call entry-level, frontline hourly jobs.
For those of you who joined us after the start, I'm speaking today with Susan Lambert, an associate professor at the University of Chicago, and Mike Brosius, assistant vice president of human resources at Costco. You're all invited to send questions in for our speakers during this audio conference call, just send them to me at Jodi, J-O-D-I-E, at CLASP, C-L-A-S-P, .org. Mike, what's Costco's practice around advance notice? Do you have any insights about some thorny issues or any tricks you've learned regarding implementation of advance notice?
Well, Jodi, at Costco, we have a minimum of at least 50% of our employees are full-time, and 50% then would be out part-time. That's the minimum number of full-timers that we've got. And the full-time schedules tend to be pretty consistent. We try to give them the same days off and the same shifts during the week. On the part-time employees, our schedules go up a minimum of 1 week in advance. And so they go up on Monday for the following week that starts on Monday. And the part-time employees are guaranteed a minimum of 24 hours a week. And, again, we try to maintain those to be as consistent as possible, but obviously as the business changes with the holidays and things like that, they are subject to change. But we give them at least, again, 1 week of notice before that.
And, Susan, you've explored how workers who might expect employer benefits like health insurance and paid time off, that they lose out on those when they don't get enough scheduled hours. Mike was just saying there's an effort to provide a core 24 hours for part-time workers. Can you fill us in on what has been your observation with respect to this fluctuation in the amount of hours tied to this benefits question?
Sure. First, let me say that it is rare and very laudable for Costco to provide minimum hours to part-time workers, that's, you know, a very rare practice. Second of all, you know, to get to your benefits thing, I mean, most firms condition benefits on both job status, whether you're in a full-time or part-time job, but also on the number of work hours. And so a number of companies that we've studied will have wonderful benefits on the books, but then if you look at particular job categories, hardly anybody can access those benefits because they never work the minimum number of hours required for them, even if they're 24 or 26 hours. And so they just don't get those. Also, when hours fluctuate, even people in full-time employment, we've found, can have their benefits be at risk of cancellation or have them actually canceled. And so when hours drop below what, you know, the employer has established for a full-time job that then comes with benefits, you know, for more than one pay period, workers in hourly jobs can lose their eligibility for things like paid time off and health insurance, even though their employer continues to categorize their job as full-time.
Hmm. Mike, you mentioned this 24-hour kind of core number for even part-time workers that you try and sustain as much as possible, and you were indicating, you know, that sometimes the holidays change things around and so forth. Is this something that has always been Costco's practice, or did you have a learning curve where you were fluctuating more and didn't have a kind of core like this? Is this something that was there from the get-go, or is this something you came to appreciate was a benefit to the company?
No, we've always had a minimum number for part-timers. It may have fluctuated slightly. I think it was 24, 25 hours at one time. We just believe that, you know, if we give them the amount of hours that they need to live on, they're going to be a lot better employee and they're going to stay with us. And again, part of the thing with the 24 hours, our average part-time is actually about 30 to 31 hours is what they average a week.
Mm-hmm.
And so the 24 hours is just the minimum that we guarantee them, but again, most of them are getting substantially more than that.
And you've mentioned lessened turnover as one of the benefits. Have you been able to analyze that and have, like, really solid metrics on that?
Yeah, our turnover has fluctuated, but it's gone. Currently, it's around 10%, which in the retail industry is an extremely low number. Then we fluctuated probably from 15 to 10%, which, again, in retail is an extremely low number, and we believe that that's a big part of our success.
It does, to be able to distinguish yourself so remarkably from other retailers in that regard. And we'll probably pick up on this question a bit later, but I want to ask Susan, in terms of public benefits, the importance of the amount of hours. If you could get back to that again in terms of what you've been able to observe, for example, with respect to TANF, the cash assistance program, or other programs, and what you'd recommend by way of solutions? Because we know you're already beginning to think about that.
Actually, you know, a lot of social benefits provided by the government are conditioned on the number of hours of work. So, for example, even taking a leave under the, Family and Medical Leave Act, people have to have worked 1,250 hours during a year with the same employer, which is about 26 hours per week. In addition, TANF, as you know, has a work requirement to continue getting any kind of cash assistance, but other benefits are also conditioned on work hours, unemployment insurance, child care subsidies. So we have a whole host of public benefits that are conditioned on work hours that assume, first of all, that workers have some kind of control over how many hours they work and that there's some kind of stability to them. But we do know that in hourly jobs, of course, that hours and income therefore change week to week. And so conditioning, I think access to social benefits on work hours puts workers almost in a double jeopardy. You know, they're at risk of losing these important supports like wage supplements, and even housing here in Chicago is conditioned on employment. So, and if there's some kind of work requirement, they can lose those supports at the same time. They're not earning as much money as they used to on their job. So one strategy I have suggested is to, instead of they keep raising the minimum hour requirements for things like TANF, but I think what we should consider is really lowering the minimum hour eligibility requirements so that they reflect the current realities of today's labor market. I mean, in many jobs, if you're not working for Costco, it's very hard to get, 25 even hours per week unless you're in a full-time job.
Mike, still focusing in on the amount of time spent at work and still also addressing public benefits programs, around the country there are state legislators and others who are giving attention to what's called fondly the cliff effect of these public benefit programs. For example, someone earns overtime or just earns so much that they become ineligible for child care subsidies. Let's say it's because of overtime for a period of time. But they really can't afford the child care without the subsidy. And that, in turn, makes it difficult for them to get to work. Is Costco hearing from employees that they can't take overtime or hearing from employees after they've lost some public benefit? I know that your employees, sort of start at $11, but depending upon the number of hours, some of them must be getting some public benefits.
Well, Jody, we don't really hear that.
Okay.
And I think part of it is our average wage, as you said, mm-hmm. and the minimum hours. And the other thing is that about 90% of our hourly employees have benefits. And even more, probably just as important as that is almost 98% of those people use our benefits because they're that good. So I don't think we have anywhere near the issue that probably some other retailers might have out there because of our starting wage and the fact that, again, our part-timers are averaging 30 hours a week. They're probably above most of those assistant levels, I'm guessing.
Okay. Susan, along the way, another public policy solution you suggested is to create what you're calling longer accounting periods to smooth variation in hours worked. Tell us, is this in lieu of or in addition to your idea to have hourly work requirements in federal programs changed to reflect current market reality that you were just describing?
Well, it's in addition to that other suggestion. I mean, basically, when workers aren't getting enough hours, they can lose benefits because they can't meet work hour requirements. But on the other hand, it's not as though hours always fluctuate down. Often hours fluctuate up, and so somebody may work more and thus exceed the income limits for certain benefits. But, and that wouldn't be a problem. That's kind of what we would like to happen to everybody. But often that additional income, as you were pointing out, is transitory. And so they earn more in the short term, but then they have the benefits cut. And so it really kind of lowers the overall household income over the long term. I mean, basically, we just have such a misfit between public policies designed today and the realities of low wage, you know, or not low, necessarily low wage, but hourly employment today. Those public policies do not recognize or help smooth variations in work hours and income that come with kind of these shifting schedules and for some workers rapid job loss. And so longer accounting periods and longer points between redetermining of people's benefit levels would, you know, kind of allow that kind of smoothing out of fluctuations in hours and earnings.
Susan, we have a question here, and I'm going to ask it. It's of you, but it's from Margot Hildreth, who's with the Center for Families in Ontario, Canada. So I wanted everyone to know that this is an international event. Hello, Margot. But the question that Margot has is with regard to national data sets in the U.S. not addressing how common it may be for employers to change an employee's schedule on short notice. What, if any, research is being conducted on a smaller scale using either a quantitative or qualitative approach to address this issue? And do these studies address the issue of choice? That is, the right to refuse, as well as the perceived implications for job security and financial stability. That's Margot's question. Susan.
Well, I would say that's the kind of research that I do. Or
maybe smaller. I would have too, but I wanted to let you say it.
Right. And that is going into companies in Chicago. I've studied 22 firms and 88 lower-level jobs, and in almost all of them, these practices are commonplace. And the issue, I think the issue of choice is one that is complicated in some of these jobs. Because most companies don't have these minimum hour guarantees, when people choose to say, well, I can't work Tuesday nights, or I'm not available for those hours, employers often are more than happy to respect that. But it doesn't mean that they're going to schedule you for times when you can work. And so what we find is that workers who put limits on their availability for work often incur what we call an earnings penalty. So they're likely to get fewer hours than somebody else who has greater availability. And often workers don't even recognize that, if they're really trading their flexibility for income.
Now, Susan, continuing, sticking with this minimum hours idea, and you've called for legislation in this arena, is there any illustration of where that's already happening?
There is, but first I want to clarify. I've raised the possibility of minimum hours legislation. I haven't kind of called for it.
Okay. duly noted. The distinction is well drawn. I apologize.
All right. I think we should consider this.
Okay.
But, you know, what we find it in some union contracts. And we find it that some employers have minimum hours, like Costco, and in certain industries, such as in hospitality and restaurant industry, to some extent, but less so, but certainly in grocery industry, there will be some contracts that have minimum hours. Also in Canada, there is what is called the three-hour rule, where employers have to pay you for at least 3 hours if you've been scheduled for work and you've had to show up. So even if you come in and you're sent home, they still have to pay you for 3 hours. The advantage of that is that it provides an incentive for employers to kind of use their labor wisely, that you just can't keep a lot of people on the payroll and use them willy-nilly. There's actually some kind of cost and incentive to think about that pool as a resource to be used.
Mike, I'm going to ask you to riff off of this point about a minimum number of hours legislation idea. And it's just a personal question, not a corporate policy question, because I know it's too provocative for that. But do you think that personally the concept of a minimum number of hours will someday make its way past the kinds of union contracts Susan mentioned, or do you think it will stay the exception rather than the rule in the decades ahead?
Well, it's hard for me to say. I mean, again, our philosophy, we're already doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And we believe that, it gets us a higher quality employee that's going to have better morale and is going to be more productive for us. So, you know, from that practical sense, it would certainly make sense to me that more employers would adopt something like that.
And would you be okay if more employers adopted that idea?
Oh, absolutely.
All right. Let's turn to the here and now, which is the Great Recession. And this is a question for both of you. We're hearing a lot of this, and I would guess that you would too. So what do you say to the argument that in this Great Recession with double-digit unemployment, caring about worker scheduling is a luxury and is better left to better economic times? Susan, your take.
We all want a strong economy and healthy businesses. I think the recession has made that very clear. But the recession has also, I think, brought into focus the vulnerability of workers and communities to employer practices. In addition to record levels of unemployment, at least in my lifetime, involuntary part-time employment is at an all-record high. As of last week, 9.2 million workers are classified as, wanting more hours. And even back in 2001, a good third of U.S. workers said they wanted more hours. So, to me, scheduling issues are fundamental. It's a fundamental business issue. It's a fundamental issue for families. And so, I would argue as we think about, at this point, it's an opportunity to think about new ways and new visions for our economy and our society. And we think that we try to think of things that will strengthen both firms and families. And I think that, to me, scheduling is, kind of where the rubber hits the road in terms of employer practices and family life. So I don't see it as a luxury.
Mike, your take?
Yeah, I would agree with Susan. We don't see it as a luxury either. We think it's just a fundamental core belief of our company that, if anything, now is probably a time when it's even more important to make sure that we're out there taking care of our employees, because we know a number of them have lost, the spouses have lost jobs and things like that. So we are doing everything we can to give our existing employees as many hours as possible. In some cases, that's meant not hiring some people so that our part-timers could continue to get, the 30 and 35 hours a week. So I would agree with Susan. Now is probably the time to take a good look at it, and it's become part of your fundamental belief.
Let's turn to best practices. And Susan, Mike has already articulated why it is that Costco views hour stability and scheduling stability as a plus for the company. Can you riff off of that and build on it to provide other data elements, other research findings that, from an employer perspective, should argue for the benefits of stable and predictable hours?
Sure. Well, overall, the organizational literature is filled with too many studies that you would never want to read. On the link between, well-designed jobs and strong, worker performance. And one quality of a good job are scheduling practices. And certainly, scheduling workers for 30 hours, right, is not all that Costco does well. But, what we see from the overall literature is that unstable hours and unstable jobs lead to an unstable workforce. And it becomes a vicious circle that employers are kind of chasing. And in terms of turnover, what we know about hourly workforce replacement is that between 30 and 50% of an hourly worker's annual pay, that's how much it costs employers to replace and train a new employee. So there's both kind of a quality performance outcome that's related to this and also a real kind of bottom line outcome.
So, Susan, if it's such a clear bottom line outcome and there's this true benefit to employers when jobs are stable and predictable and flexible for the employee, why isn't it that more employers practice this? What's the barrier in your mind?
I think we should ask Mike that. I ask myself that question every day.
Uh-huh.
Certainly one of the things that we've seen is this uptake in terms of these labor flexibility practices on the part of employers. And part of that is kind of recent press on the part of businesses to adopt business models in which they're pursuing profit much more through cost containment than through quality enhancement or what we call differentiation strategies. And so, you know, last minute posting a work schedule, scheduling workers for very short shifts of work, you know, keeping that workforce flexible just really helps managers maintain a tight link between their labor costs and their outlays for wages. In the short run, in the long term, it can create high levels of turnover and other kinds of problems that detract from the bottom line. So I would like to hear, you know, what Mike thinks about the reasons for that.
Okay, well, let me frame it this way, in the form of a confession, Mike. I invited Costco to this program and asked you onto this program because I'd read a quote in Workforce Management. It was an article about the new software that enables employers to match employee schedules to demand, even down to microshifts. And a Costco official was described in this article as, quote, cautious about assigning shifts purely based on store demand. And the official actually said, quote, we're dealing with people's lives when we schedule them. We've got to be sensitive to that. So first, I'd like to hear how you all got to this best practice, and it sounds like it's just something you were born with, and then why you think other employers don't have that same gene in their system.
Well, I think, as you said, Joni, I mean, it's just part of our culture. It's what we've started with. Our CEO, Jim Sinegal, has always stressed the importance of people. And he's always stressed the importance that, you know, if we pay them a good wage, we provide them good benefits, we're going to have a better employee who's going to be our best marketer out on the street talking about our business. And that's just part of what we do. So, you know, I don't know that we do it consciously. It's just, again, what we've always done. And we think it's just the best practice for us. And it's resulted in the low turnover, the higher morale, and a much better employee for us. So, you know, for us, it works. I can't say whether that's the right concept for everybody, but, again, it's worked very well for us in our 27 years.
Well, let me ask you the question about scheduling in a flipped way. You know, others, your competitors, for example, may now be beginning to use some of this software more aggressively and doing just-in-time production and just-in-time scheduling. And you clearly perceive, believe, feel, and know about some of the advantages you're experiencing from not doing it that way. Are you at all worried that, you know, the rest of the business world, some of your competitors may be shifting how they arrange these things, and that may cause you to have to shift too?
Well, I think, you know, productivity is obviously the number one issue in our warehouses as well as everybody else in retail because payroll is such a key factor in your profitability. So we look at it all the time as well, but I think as that comment or the quote that you had given, you know, we don't do it at the expense of the employees.
Mm-hmm.
We've got minimum work hours. That if we're going to schedule them, they're working a minimum of 4-hour shifts. And we've got all the minimum set up for the weekly hours and things like that. So we think we can do both. And if you look at our productivity in the retail business, we are by far the most productive retailer in the country.
So if you were in a meeting with another firm and talking about the benefits to Costco of stable scheduling, core number of hours, and another firm came along and says, you know, my firm does just fine without spending the energy to consider employees' scheduling needs, would you say to them, that's a short-term perspective? Or would you say, okay, fine, or what argument would you make back to them?
Well, I think, you know, we're not running their business. They're
right.
Running their business.
Right.
But, you know, my thing back to them would be, you know, what is your total cost? As Susan has said, you know, there's a cost to turnover. There's also a cost that's not really measurable to the morale of the people that you've got working for you. And if they're not, you want them to be your best ambassadors about your business. And if you're not taking good care of them, they're certainly not going to be out there counting your business. So there's a cost to that, and we feel that that's part of why we do what we do.
You know, one of the costs we haven't identified yet is the health care costs. Susan, in some of her own research and in others' research, has noted that the stress of work-life conflicts has negative health impacts, and of course that stress then in turn could increase health-related costs. And I understand that you all at Costco were genetically coded to have a sort of set of approaches to scheduling and work-life balance for employees. But have you ever at least calculated reduced health care costs related to this stress variable? Is that something you've looked at?
I don't know that we've looked at it from a stress variable, but, you know, health care, you know, it's no secret. It's a huge expense, and it's growing for our company at roughly 15% a year, and it's the number one expense we have after payroll. And so, you know, we're always looking at ways to try to reduce that, but conversely, again, almost 90% of our employees are on health care, and almost 100% of them are using us, and so we're going to continue to provide the best care we can. At the same time, we're going to try to encourage them to use those that smartly.
So, how do you recommend that some of these best practices be fostered at the same time as the software is really coming onto the market to do just-in-time scheduling of hourly workers?
Well, I think one point is that, you know, the scheduling software can be, to put it bluntly, a tool for good and a tool for evil, right? You know, it's not inherent in the software how businesses use it. And scheduling software that's implemented by a company like Costco is going to have a very different outcome that's implemented by other firms who are trying to keep that really tight link between, you know, traffic and who watch it hour by hour and send people in, you know, send people home if traffic isn't meeting, you know, last year's hours. And there are certainly some big box places that do that. So it's not in the software. And so I think what we need is we need consultants who are implementing these scheduling packages, and we need people in industry and businesses to consider the different ways that these scheduling practices can be implemented and to model, I think, for other employers a way that these scheduling new scheduling systems can actually do a great job of balancing the needs for business for cost containment. Certainly, you know, labor costs need to be contained. They don't necessarily need to be absolutely minimized in a way and implemented in a way that also supports our workers, you know, in their places of business.
So, Susan, in the places where you have done research and the employers are using this for good and not for evil, this software packaging opportunity. What is it, do you think, that led them to take that path? In other words, we're still trying to get back to why aren't more employers doing this if it's in their own self-interest?
Now, in my research, I have not studied the implementation of these scheduling packages per se. And so I can't... you know, I've studied scheduling overall. A lot of firms still do it by hand.
we have 113,000 employees. That would be pretty tough, right, Mike?
a little more complicated than you'd like it to be.
Right, but, you know, still, some people, you know, are they do it on their spreadsheets or they break it down to the, you know, the what often happens is that a department manager will get so many hours that they have to spread among their staff. And they put it into, you know, and they still write off the schedule. You would be surprised at how many firms that still happens at. But increasingly, it is becoming computerized, and the software is becoming, you know, much more sophisticated in terms of relating, you know, being able to specify the number of workers who, if it's totally based on consumer demand, who should be on the, you know, who should be on the floor, who should be on the line, who should be in the restaurant.
I'm going to turn to the audience for a live question from Liz Watkins, who works at Workplace Flexibility 2010 here in D.C. Liz, how are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks, Jody, and thanks to both of our speakers. This has been really interesting. Susan, you explained in your remarks that promoting choice in scheduling is a really complicated thing. And that if employees limit their availability, what often happens is that they incur an earnings penalty. So there's an unintended effect there. My question for you is, what are some ways to encourage employers to provide employees with more choice or input into their work schedules without resulting in this unintended consequence of an earnings penalty? Thanks.
Well, I think, you know, to me, the difference is whether you have that minimum hour guarantee, so that you know when you're making a choice in terms of the scheduling of when you work, you know that you're not going to have to trade your 20 hours a week, some of that in order not to work Tuesday nights, for example. So it is just hard for, you know, given what I see on the front lines of firms, it's very hard to think about how any kind of choice could not result in an earnings penalty without some kind of minimum hours. Now, that isn't to say that we shouldn't provide people with that choice, even in that context, because you know what? Some people would take fewer hours given that they can work at a time that allows them to, you know, better manage their other responsibilities, whatever they might be. Liz?
Thanks. I guess one follow-up to that is, I think in your scheduling intervention study that you have underway, the main focus is around moving the amount of notice that employers give to their employees in the retail store that you're studying to a month, posting schedules a month ahead of time. But is there also some component of trying to increase communication about choice and scheduling of hours between managers and employees? And if so, how has that intervention component worked?
Well, that was, you remember well. That was going to be a component of our intervention, but the firm that we're working with actually went ahead and improved that on their own, which is great. And so they implemented a calendar system where people could write down when they wanted, you know, time off and when they wanted more hours. But because it isn't part of our experiment, we can't really judge whether the workers who, you know, kind of use that are, you know, in fact working fewer hours than they would if they said I could work any time at all.
Liz, while we've got you on, would you like to toss a question to Mike?
Well, Mike, it's been very, very interesting to hear about what Costco is doing and learn a little bit more, especially on the stability of hours point. Is there, and I know, you know, you're somewhat reluctant to tell other employers what to do, but the example that we have from best practice employers like Costco is really something that the rest of us would like to figure out how to leverage in some way to encourage other firms to behave like you all do. Do you have any idea about how employers of choice like yourselves can, you know, be brought in to market this concept to other employers in your industry or you know, more systemically?
Wow. You know, I think most of our information that we've talked about today is pretty public knowledge. We go out there and talk about this all the time. So I would like to think that large retailers or other firms would look at our success and model, you know, their behaviors after what's worked for us. But, you know, we're certainly available for anything.
We're going to take you up on that.
You know, but if there's something like that we can help, we're certainly willing to do so.
That'd be terrific. I'd like to close by giving each of my guests an opportunity to ask a question of the other. So, for example, Mike, you're sitting there, HR division of Costco. You have a researcher who's steeped in a whole set of issues regarding work life, scheduling, so on and so forth. Whether or not she's researched this question before, let's just kind of assume she can answer any question you might want to ask her. So you're up first.
Good assumption.
All right.
There you go. So what would be the kind of thing you'd want to ask a researcher that would help you in your work right now with regard to scheduling issues, workers' work-life matters that even if Susan herself hasn't done anything about, we can add to somebody's plate or to hers?
Okay, well, I've got two, Susan, okay? One would be, have you seen the trend? Has the trend changing dramatically from where it was, you know, 10 or 15 years ago? out there with part-time versus full-time and this whole, you know, productivity and things like that. So I guess that's more of a generic question. And then secondly, are you seeing that what's more important to employees today? Is it the hours and the pay, or do they want some sort of a balance with time off and, you know, the ability to spend more time with family and things like that? So I'm just wondering which of those is becoming more important.
Okay. I can address both of those. certainly what we've seen in terms of the part-time versus full-time is that the proportion of the workforce that stays part-time fluctuates somewhat, but it doesn't fluctuate all that much. So it goes between like 14% to a peak of like 17% at any one time. And what we see is that stays about the same. Now, we've seen a huge peak in part-time, you know, during the recession as people's hours are reduced, but without that blip, that's kind of what we see. But that hides a great deal of variation in the economy. There are pockets of employment, one of them being retail, where there's just increasing growth in part-time employment. So Costco maintains this 50%, right, full-time, part-time. That is, you know, from our research, that's incredibly unusual. In most stores that we see, and in department stores and in other big box, the ratio tends to be more 70% part-time, 30% full-time at best, and it's slipping toward 80% to 20%. And the reason, a lot of people think that the reason for that is so that employers can, you know, keep their benefit costs down. But really, according to research by Susan Hausman at the Upjohn Institute, that's not the major reason that employers are preferring a greater part-time staff. And instead, it's because only about, in part-time jobs, only about, well, 18% of workers get health benefits, but even full-time ones, only 56% of employers pay for their health insurance. So that's not the biggest factor. The biggest factor is to allow for greater flexibility in scheduling so that workers can be scheduled for short shifts of work. So that's one of the reasons toward this part-time trend. The other thing in terms of workers, there's a big press towards flexibility. This flexibility is something that American workers and other workers around the world, I think, very much want. They're willing, to some extent, trade income for flexibility, and so that is absolutely something that today's workforce want to have in terms of balancing their work and life responsibilities. But I think one of the things we have to keep in mind is that we do have a growing kind of issue of underemployment in the country. And so, again, even in 2001, 30% of workers said that they would prefer to work more hours rather than fewer hours.
And Susan, it's your turn to ask Mike a question.
Well, yes, I would be very interested in hearing how the, you know, kind of the upper level corporate support for having these minimum hours for workers, how that's translated down to the supervisors, you know, how that gets communicated, and also the kind of accountability requirements that Costco places on frontline managers to help ensure that there's 50% full-time versus, 50% part-time in the warehouses, and to help ensure that that really, day-to-day, the majority of part-time workers get those, 24 hours a week.
Okay, well, good question. Well, on the full-time, part-time, we have a group of our senior vice presidents that come up to Seattle once a month. And at every single meeting, we put up the full-time, part-time percentages
wow.
in each of the regions. So there is no hiding.
Wow.
And we put it up by warehouses. So, and it's just a mantra. So that does not deviate. And as a matter of fact, we're much higher than 50% right now, and we're
wow.
thinking of contemplating going higher than that as a minimum.
Wow.
So that's just the culture. And I think that kind of is the same thing with the supervisors. I mean, in our handbook, in our employee agreement, we specify that the minimum number of hours worked for part-time is 24. And from a benefit eligibility, what has to happen is they have to average 20 hours or less over the course of 6 months to have a benefit change. And for the full-timers, they go from 40 and they have to average under 34 for 6 months. So it's not a fluctuation of 1 month. You happen to take a little bit more time off for whatever reason. It's a six-month interval. Mm-hmm. And then they can, and you know, the following 6 months, if it changes, they move back and forth within the system from full-time to part-time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just part of the mantra.
But
part of the Kool-Aid.
But I think it's great. I mean, you're held accountable for it, too.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah. I want to thank you both for joining class in this audio conference on scheduling hours for workers in a just-in-time world. I think this conversation's been very illuminating, very exciting, and I thank Susan Lambert from the University of Chicago and Mike Brosius of Human Resources at Costco. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Jody.
Have a great day, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.